over there.
Questions or comments here? People are ready to jump into it, Ian.
Oh, good. All right. Well, I'm chairing the first two sessions up until the break, which is lunchtime for us and breakfast for the United States. And then Jim gets the easy one after lunch. I think that was good planning on our part. So I'd like to ask Mark and Andy to tee up this first topic, agenda paper number 6.
Thank you, Ian. Good morning, everyone. The first agenda item today relates to customer options for additional goods and services and non-refundable upfront fees. The new revenue standard requires an entity to account for an option for additional goods and services as a separate performance obligation if that option provides a material right to the customer that it would not receive without entering into that contract. In addition, the new revenue standard states that the period over which a non-refundable fee would be recognized as revenue may extend beyond the initial contractual period if the entity grants the customer the option to renew the contract and that option provides the customer with a material right. Stakeholders have informed the staff of several issues regarding the evaluation of whether a customer option gives rise to a material right. We've outlined two issues in the agenda paper, and what we'd like to do is to walk through the first issue, ask for the resource group's feedback, and before moving on to the second issue. So the first issue is whether the evaluation of a customer option should be formed only in the context of the current transaction, or if the evaluation also should consider past and expected future transactions. Those who believe that the evaluation should consider only factors existing in the current transaction, and that's view A in the agenda paper, look to the guidance in the new revenue standard that states that the new revenue standard specifies the accounting for an individual contract. And those who believe that the evaluation should consider factors existing in the current, past, and expected future transactions, that's view B in the paper, look to the guidance in the new revenue standard that indicates when evaluating a contract term such as a discount, an entity would look to factors outside of the current transaction, such as transactions with a similar class of customer. We've included two examples in the agenda paper that we think help illustrate the various views. The first example relates to a customer loyalty program where a customer earns loyalty points for purchases. Those points accumulate and ultimately can be redeemed for a free good or service. And then the second example relates to kind of a traditional, what we used as a buy three, get one free promotion. So with that, the staff would appreciate the resource group's feedback on how they would evaluate factors, what factors they would evaluate when determining whether the option in each one of the examples provides a customer with the material right.
Okay, thank you. So will we begin in London? Any comments from the group here on those two views? Slow start. Tony.
Okay, so I'll kick it off. I guess with this one, I might have, maybe teed up the question slightly differently. Because I think, think about the way you might ordinarily think about materiality, and you'd think, well, does materiality influence, in the context of financial statements, the users of financial statements? And in this context, when I'm thinking about a material right, I'm thinking that lots of these programs are designed to influence the behavior of customers. And for that reason, I think I'd be inclined more towards a view B, but I would look at it and say that I can see that the programs are designed to influence the behavior of customers, and for that reason, the award that is granted or the right that is granted in each transaction would typically be a material right. I think I might also look at it and say, you need to consider the nature of what the customer has received each time. And if the customer receives something that accumulates together with other things, then you might not be taking the other transactions into account, but you are taking into account the nature of the item and the fact that it accumulates. And so therefore I will be inclined in both of these examples to see them as material rights. My sense in this case is that the standard is clear in this respect, and it's operational and can be interpreted, and I don't think there's any need for for any further standard setting.
But basically, you're sort of saying that the accumulation is actually an intrinsic feature of the thing that you're evaluating. It's an
yes.
intrinsic feature of that, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, so I fully agree with what Tony is saying, and I am also as such in the camp of view B. And I do think that you have to look beyond the sole transaction, so you have to consider other facts and circumstances. And I also agree that with the current standard as it stands, we could come to the proper conclusion, so we didn't find it troublesome to come to these views. And there's maybe one additional remark I'd like to make specifically to this buy three, get one free. One might view this, in fact, as a change to the standard selling price, in fact, as opposed to an option. And while the outcome will be the same in the accounting, we think that what the entity is doing here, it's really offering one unit and promising one third of another unit. So it's effectively changing its standard selling price. It's just not handing over that one third. So the customer has to buy three, and with the third, it's going to hand over the fourth. And we see this, in fact, as a change in the standalone selling price, in the sense that the standalone selling price is always amount times price. In this case, the price is constant. Let's assume it continues to be 100. It's just the amount that the customer or the entity will be providing is one third more than maybe in the past. But I think that at the end of the day, whether it's a change in the standalone selling price or accounted for as an option, the accounting will be the same. So it's just a different path, but it will lead to the same outcome.
Okay. Brian?
I think similar overall. I'm not sure I would articulate the question in precisely the same way, because I think it's clear that the contract is the unit of account for applying the standard. But I think it is, as others have said, within the nature of these rights, they do accumulate, and if I don't have regard to that when trying to work out how to account for the individual contract, I feel that I'm missing a very important element of the analysis. When I look in other parts of the standard, the example on customer loyalty programs that I think is quoted in the paper is a relatively extreme example, in that the value of the point in that example seems to be relatively large compared to any of the schemes in which I participate personally. but I think it does bring out the point that you look at the points together in deciding how to account. I also think there's a little nudge in the BC where you discuss credit card loyalty programs and was it worthwhile the board looking at the more complex arrangements that involve more than two parties, and it seems to be inherent in the reasons why the board didn't take on that more difficult fact pattern that there was a fairly clear answer for dealing with the simpler fact patterns that only involve two parties.
Okay, any further comments? So far we've had three of view B. Anybody got view A view? We don't have any view A's. No. A lot of shaking of heads. So, Jim, I'll pass it over to you for Norwalk.
Great. Hopefully it's clear in Norwalk.
I'll speak if you want. I agree with everybody else. I think I'm in the view B camp as well.
Rita.
Thank you. I'm also in the view B camp for a particular loyalty program like this, but I wondered if you broadened the scope of the issue to, let's say, a consumer products manufacturer who's working with a large retailer and decides they're going to put trade promotions in the context of this loyalty or continuity in terms of promotion and selling. Today that would be a deduction to revenue. Under this application, it would then be a bifurcation of revenue. And I just wondered how you would think about that distinction.
S- Staff want to comment on that?
Could you clarify what you mean by a trade promotion?
An incentive to buy a larger quantity or at a different time or a different type of bundle of products, you know, multi-packs and longer timing of promotions.
Think of that more as you'd have to walk that through the consideration payable to a customer guidance as opposed to the customer option guidance, I guess.
So my point is, if you put it in the context of a program as opposed to a one-time contract, would it change it?
I guess, you know, willing to jump out on a ledge here, would you have to start with whether that right meets sort of the criteria to be a distinct performance obligation? And so, I mean, I guess, don't know every trade program. I guess if they did, you might be in a model that's more like this. If it's not, I think you are then in the sort of the model that Mark was talking about.
So it's not a concern either way, but it's just understanding that it would have a different revenue line.
Right. But I think they probably both would result in deferral of revenue. The exact, you know, amounts and mechanics could vary slightly if you're in the model that Mark was referring to, where you're saying, no, the transaction price isn't 100, it's only 90, or you're in what Jim was talking about, you actually have a material right, so it's, you know, a separate unit to account for. So the amounts potentially could be slightly different, but you'd still end up with the entity deferring, you know, some amount of revenue.
But today you don't, right?
For the transaction price element, you would. For the right, I think it would depend.
Others in? Allison, you look like you're...
Mark and I are like looking at each other.
If I don't see you and you want to get in the queue, just put... You don't have to, but...
I apologize. Yeah,
no problem.
No, at first I was just going to react that I think maybe under today's practice, if you're promising to provide future goods, that might walk through the multiple element guidance, and as Colin was saying, might end up resulting in a deferral of revenue versus if you're offering like a discount or something off of future products. That might end up being a rebate or reduction of revenue today. So I guess that's I think, the way that we think about it in today's model. For this particular issue, we were in a VUB model as well for these. And part of, you know, the reason for reaching that conclusion, you know, I think it was helpful to have the loyalty point example included in the paper, because to me, as I was looking at the loyalty points, I had thought, well, in what how many instances would you end up with something that would be a material right if you're just looking at the individual contract and the individual points that are being accumulated for an item? And so, and if you follow that all the way through, in instances when you would conclude that you don't have a material right, an entity would likely still need to account for its obligation to provide a future benefit, which I think companies would then account for under an similar to how some do today under an incremental cost approach, and that seemed to be inconsistent with where I think we thought the standard was heading in terms of identifying performance obligations and not using an incremental cost approach to account for those types of programs. So that was one observation, and then I also thought that just going back into the words into the standard and some of the principles in the standard seem to be focusing very much on understanding the explicit promises in an arrangement, but also the implied promises, and really understanding the terms between the two parties and as they have been negotiated. And it seems to me that going with a VUB approach acknowledges that there could very well be part of the negotiated exchange this particular option or ability for a customer to get future goods and services at a particular price. So that's what led us down a VUB path.
Mark?
Yeah, I'm probably going to rock the boat a little here, but I think VUB I think we're fine with that. I think it's the easier answer, less complex. But we do have differing views in our firm on this, and it's really we look at there's some that do cost accrual today for their points programs, and I think they're looking at example 52 where it's 10%. And they're saying, well, that example clearly says that 10% is material, and therefore, if my program's only 1% or 2%, that might not be material. So they look at that and they say, did they intentionally put make that 10%? And I think someone mentioned that that's a huge amount. I don't have any loyalty point programs that give me that much power. But, you know, I think they look at that and they say, well, that example is clearly material, and ours isn't. So we can continue to potentially do our cost accrual model. A lot of companies already do the deferral of revenue. So you look at that, and you look at, you know, the whole context of this standard is in the context of the contract, looking at the specific contract and whether or not that is material. So there's definitely people that believe that they look at that. And I think example three is the one, the discount voucher, where everyone that purchases something one day gets a voucher. Is that going to be a material right or not? View B, I think you can look at it in totality and conclude either the whole program is in or the whole program is out. The idea that each customer that walks in that day, you have a different accounting for, would be a little bit complex. But I assume view B on example three would allow us to, you know, say either the whole program's in or the whole program's out, and you wouldn't have to look at it on an individual contract basis. But that does run a bit contrary to the standard says, account for the individual contract, and that's why there's people that are sort of have mixed feelings about this and don't think it's exactly clear in the standard. So if someone would come to us and say our program, all you earn is less than 1% every time you make a purchase, and they say that's not a material right, I assume everyone would object to that accounting because it accumulates. And there's nothing in the standard that says because it accumulates that makes it a material right, but I'm fine with that view, but I don't know whether the standard exactly tells you that's what you got to do.
Larry?
Yeah, I found example three to be a little disturbing, particularly the parenthetical in the second line about that you get that coupon regardless of the size of your acquisition. So a person could go into the store and buy a $200 item, get a coupon for 25% off, and the next item they buy, you know, could be of any size. And then the same person or a different person could go in and buy a pack of gum and get a 25% off coupon, and the next item that they buy is $500 or something. So that one, I kind of paused and said, this is just like, you know, flooding the market with coupons, and I could easily see somebody concluding, because of the fact that there's no restriction on the size of your purchase to begin with to get the coupon, that effectively it's like any other coupon and not, you know, not deferral.
Are we moving on to the next topic, the next issue? I thought example three was to do with issue two.
It does, Ian. It's just that Mark mentioned it, so.
But I think it's hard to differentiate the two issues. I mean, it's all one analysis in my mind.
But it seemed to me we were coming to a conclusion on issue one. If we could do that and then move on to issue two, I think it'd be a better process.
Gotcha. Daryl?
I want to go back and ask a question to Mark, just to make sure that I'm understanding his point of view. Mark, are you saying, are you allowing for the possibility that under a view B, which is, you know, a more expanded view of what constitutes a material right for a particular customer, are you allowing for the fact that even if you take that more expanded view, you could conclude for an individual customer that they're not being granted a material right, but yet because in totality the program may be viewed as granting material rights in total, that then effectively you would push down that notion from the program level down to the individual customers? Is that the way that you're looking at that?
Well, I think people do look at it that way. Some do. What I personally believe, you know, I can go back and forth. I mean, I hear arguments. I mean, people look at that example and they say, that's 10%. So this is, when I look at mine is less than 1%. So therefore, mine's not a material right. You know, maybe if that example either lowers the threshold or says the reason why this is being a material right is because it accumulates, and that would clarify that you need to look at it broadly.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I think from a practical standpoint, that's probably the way a lot of people look at it. I'm just trying to figure out how to shoehorn that type of thinking into, you know, the words that are there. And it seems that, to me, we're looking at it from a customer and a contract standpoint versus a program standpoint, but yet I understand how you're getting to the view that you're getting to.
But kind of follow, the difference between example 1, 2, and 3, in example 1 and 2, you've got transactions with customers where the ultimate free item accumulates, and it's the accumulation that makes it significant or material, and I think that's why everyone's comfortable with view B there. In example 3, you have individual transactions with customers. The individual transactions with the individual customer does not accumulate. You only get one 25% off coupon. As a total, the totality of the program with all of your customers creates a material amount to the company. So I can see how you can look at example 3 different than example 1 and 2. Because I think example 1 and 2 clearly accumulates to the customer over time. I think that's clearly view B. I can see a distinction why you might have a different answer in 3. So maybe Ian's right as we should move on to examples or issue 2.
Yeah, Ian, why don't we?
That's your point, really, right?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. View B is fine. I just want to make sure everyone understands what the other people are thinking out there.
Ian, I think why don't we turn it back over to London and move on to the next issue.
Okay, thanks, Jim. So if the staff would like to tee up issue 2.
Sure. So the second issue is, once you've identified the transactions that you're looking at, whether the evaluation of a customer option is solely a quantitative evaluation or if it also considers qualitative factors. So those who believe that the evaluation is only quantitative in nature, so that's view A in the paper, point to a discussion in the basis that they believe indicates that the evaluation of a material right is similar to guidance in current U.S. GAAP that requires an entity to consider whether a discount is quantitatively incremental to the range of discounts typically given in comparable transactions. Those who subscribe to view B or believe that the evaluation should consider both qualitative and quantitative factors believe that consideration of qualitative factors is more consistent with the notion that identifying promised goods or services should consider the expectations of a customer. And those from a customer's perspective on what constitutes a material right, that may consider any number of qualitative factors. So again, we've included 2 examples in the paper to help illustrate these 2 views. As we've talked about already, the first includes a discount voucher where you purchase a product, you get a voucher for a discount on a future purchase. And then the second example involves the evaluation of a material right in which there's a non-refundable upfront fee that doesn't relate to a promised good or service, and that fee is combined with a contract renewal option. Again, staff would turn it to the resource group to get their views on how they would evaluate those 2 examples.
Okay, thank you. Brian, I didn't recognize you before. If you wish to make a point on the previous one, that's okay.
I did just have, if people will forgive me, just one closing comment on the previous discussion, because I was the other person who mentioned example 52, which seems to feature the relatively generous customer loyalty program. And I just wanted to make a general comment that perhaps relates to a number of examples in the standard, that my working assumption when I read those examples is that the numbers are chosen to illustrate a clear-cut case, and to show you the maths of how you would do it, and that the numbers are not there in any sense to set a boundary or to try to describe where you would tip from one accounting to the other. And I just wondered if that was a shared way in which people were reading the examples.
Well, I'm not sure everybody's reading them that way, but I think your
but that's how they were written.
Seems of a way of reading.
There's always the risk, you know, that people take more clues from the example than was ever intended, because their purpose is so often is purely illustrative, and I personally think it is along the lines that you said, Brian.
Now, issue 2. Any comments on issue 2 in London? I'm going for a slow start again. Jane.
Sort of applies to issues one and two. I think this, and I'm speaking from a user's perspective, it's not ideal to get hung up on actual numbers for materiality. Obviously, from an investor's perspective, all these deals are giving future sales away. And so that is a material issue. I don't know whether material right should be interpreted as a right to more than, you know, 5%, something that will amount to a value of 5% of future sales, or whether it's actually immaterial in the sense of it's an important right or a significant right, or one that in principle gives something away in terms of revenues.
Andrew.
On issue two, although we had a little bit of discussion on issue one, our organization, issue two, is very much into view B. And rather in the same way as Brian's articulated, when we looked at the discount voucher example, we rather assumed that the numbers had been chosen to illustrate the point rather than necessarily be something that you would see in the retail outlet. But in many cases, you do see these in practice where there's a minimum spend for the first transaction and then there's a fairly large amount off for subsequent ones. Sometimes just when people want to clear the shop of something which has got a pretty high profit margin on it anyway. Similarly, when we got to example four, it seemed that view B would be the approach that we would take, because the fact that people are then able to rotate off to another supplier and there isn't an incremental cost, there is a similar service, that tends to suggest that there isn't a right at that point. And therefore, you would be into view B because you could go to another supplier without too much trouble.
Okay, Mike.
Yes, so also I am in view B here. I'd just like to make one additional comment to example three on the discount voucher. When I read this, I thought, well, if I have to account for this, I would have to make some very significant estimates here, both on whether a customer will come back, but the fact said here, typically customers do come back, make an additional purchase. But then obviously I'd have to estimate the size of the next purchase in order to determine what is 25% of that purchase. And there's one more fact that here that says that the entity only offers this on one particular day. So this made me think that if this entity sells on the 364 other days its goods and services at a certain price and was able to establish a standalone selling price on this very specific day to offer something that becomes apparently significant, this must be a material right. So I couldn't even think of a fact pattern that you come out of this situation without concluding that this is a material right.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments? Tony.
I think just to echo what the others have said, I think we would also be in view B, and we'd come at it from the perspective that you need to consider all of the factors to determine whether or not something is being given to the customer in a way that is designed to influence the customer's behavior. I think if something is being given away to the customer in the transaction, I think the standard points you towards accounting for that as a material right. Like others, I wouldn't get hung up on, if you like, on the specific numbers or features of the examples, because they are there to illustrate, and I think they're there to illustrate the point that you need to identify whether there is something being given to a customer to influence their behavior. And if that's the case, I think the standard points you towards it being a material right.
Okay. All right, Jim?
Folks in Norwood? Greg.
So, Jim, consistent with the folks in London, I think when we looked at this question, we theoretically kind of agree that you should look at qualitative factors in addition to just quantitative factors, you know, consistent with the paragraph 87 in the basis of conclusions that states you should look at the valid expectations of the customer. We didn't so much try to solve these problems by determining if the right given was material, because the question that was asked was the consideration that you would undertake to determine if the right was material. So I think both in both cases, kind of we looked at view B as well in the first example. I didn't get in on that one, but and consistent on this one. But one comment on something Brian said, you know, and when he read the standard, he looks at quantitative thresholds in the examples as kind of trying to draw a clear case. There is a danger in that. I've been, you know, doing this for a while, and you can get audited to quantitative examples in standards by your auditor. So to the extent that the boards believe they're there to just describe a very clear case, it would be helpful to assert that, because there are many standards where if it says 10 and you're at 11, it's 11.
So as one board member, I would agree with Ian. They weren't meant to set thresholds from my perspective, but there's other board members that I think we're hearing people affirm what you asked. That is, those are not there to set a threshold, but to illustrate cases and the math and the thought process, not to establish a threshold.
And that was my expectation. Because I think at the end of the day, the determination of materiality after going through the evaluation process is a case-by-case example.
I think you made a very important first point as well, which is this is about the thought process you would go through to evaluate a material right. I don't think it was the discussion here, I don't think, should be meant to say, is a particular program material or not? And I suspect that people may have, you know, hopefully we have a thought process that gives a framework to reach relatively consistent outcomes, but I'm certain there will be judgment cases. Even the example three where, you know, depending on the program, I think Larry raised the point that if you could come in, buy a pack of gum and get 25% off, does that really feel like, and somebody else buys, you know, a $500, you know, item, that program may differ in terms of somebody's judgment, I would think, if a program had different terms that said you must buy a $500 item in order to get 25% off your next purchase. I'm not trying to declare outcomes, but I think, Greg, your point was an important one. Marty?
Yeah, that's the point that's been just troubling me a little bit as I've heard this discussion, and that you've set a framework here that seems to bear on that view B is take into account quantitative and qualitative factors in evaluating whether the transaction gives rise or the program gives rise to a material right. But it sounds like company A could come to one view, and with the same program, company B could come to a different view, and the auditor could come to one view and a different view. So there's a framework here, but it's very judgmental. Is that a fair assessment?
I would have thought there may be judgment cases somewhere in a margin, but I think what we're generally hearing is, at least I'll summarize, is that a lot of these programs that I think people may have been doing cost accrual for in the past actually do end up resulting in material rights. Am I missing the sense of that discussion, Scott?
I was also in view B, but perhaps illustrating a little bit of this judgment. Reading example four, while I'm definitely view B, and I think you got to take into account quantitative and qualitative factors, the analysis for view B in example four is not where I'd have gone, because I'd have thought that entity A in the example, by essentially charging more for its services, was saying our services are better than our competitors. Therefore, the fact that the competitors are willing to let people sign up without an initiation fee doesn't help entity A conclude that it isn't giving a material right. I mean, I think part of the analysis, if you're going to point at, well, you could buy the same service somewhere else, is really whether it's the same service. For a retailer, it might work when it's literally the same branded product being sold at different stores. But a telecommunications service provider, I'd have a hard time, I think, accepting off the bat that because there's a competitor that also sells telecommunications services cheaper, I don't have to worry about my material rights. So I think it is qualitative and quantitative. It has to be. The use of the word material, I think, can't be limited to just quantitative. But I was a little dismayed at the analysis in view B of example four.
So I'm also in view B, but a little bit concerned practically how this will work. If you have to make a determination that buying a stick of gum is not material, but buying some equipment is, and you're going to have to do this sort of what Mark was saying before on an individual by individual basis, it's not going to be a workable analysis. I mean, it just becomes way too complicated.
That's not the way I would evaluate it. I would evaluate it qualitatively to say that effectively anybody can get that coupon. All you have to do is walk in the store and drop a quarter on the counter and effectively you get that coupon. To me, that's a coupon drop. It has nothing to do with the sales of the pack of gum or the sale of this $400 item. It's just a coupon drop, and that's the way I would conclude on that item.
In fact, that might be illustrated.
It's not a material right, exactly.
Which might be illustrated by the fact if you were actually to do the accounting, if that were a material right, the amount you would allocate to that right would be vastly different depending on the individual who bought a pack of gum, because you only have 25 cents of total consideration to even allocate.
I don't even know how I would. I don't know how I would make that estimate, because then you'd have negative revenue effectively.
In fact, if you could get it for a pack of gum, that might be indicative of the fact that the standalone value might not be greater than the pack of gum.
Thanks, Jim. I think the points that I think we're making here, but I hear on the other side that those would be material rights. They all said view B, their view B, and those would be material rights because it's 25, percent. I think the realistic example is, you go to an online retailer, you buy something, and they throw the coupon in the box, and everyone gets the coupon that buys something that day. You know, are those material rights? Under view B, the way I would look at it is, I'd look at it in totality and say, like you say, everyone's getting it, regardless of what you purchase. It's really not a material right. It's just sort of a marketing thing that we're doing. What I also hear some people saying is under that view, no, that's a material right you're getting. You got to put a value on it. You got to come up, what's the average purchase, I guess, what's the standalone selling price of that coupon, and then allocate it between whatever that person bought that day. So I hear two different ways of looking at view B, and I guess to Marty's point, it's if one company says I'm going to deem that a material right, and one company says they don't, is one of them wrong or are both of them right? And that's where
both of them are wrong.
Or both of them both of them are wrong. in regards to I'm the one that raised the 10% in the example 52. I didn't raise it to say it was a bright line cutoff. It's very clear in that example to me that they're saying that is material because it's 10%, not saying 10% is the cutoff. But it's saying that's something you should evaluate in determining whether it's material. So therefore, someone says, I clearly got something that's not material. It's one less than 1%. I'm not saying 1% is not material or 11% is. I'm just saying in that example, in the point I think they're trying to make is that 10% is material, therefore you have a material right. What I hear here is it doesn't matter what the percentage is. It doesn't matter if it was 10%, 20%, or 0.0%. If it accumulates, it's a material right. Is that not what I'm...
I'm not sure that people are getting into thresholds versus an evaluation of the entire program.
Is the threshold even evaluated at all if it accumulates?
I don't think I heard anybody say it accumulates ergo material. I think what I heard everybody say is the fact that it accumulates must be considered.
So you could have some that accumulate that someone deems not material.
If it doesn't create a valid expectation of the customer that they'll be able to exercise it, then maybe it's not material right.
Maybe you're spending your money on a program that doesn't work.
Yep.
done that.
Russ, you look like... others in Norwalk? Ian, back to you.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Well, anybody here got any final comments, or everybody happy? We're done on this. Seem to be happy. So my instructions say I have to sum up, which I think I've got a relatively easy one. If we go to issue one, I think there was almost complete unanimity on view B. There was concern about the examples, and we had a good discussion, I think, on the examples, and I think there's a fair amount of agreement on what examples are for and how they work in the standards and how you should view them, so that needs to be kept in mind. On issue two, I didn't hear anybody supporting view A, only view B, but a bit of a concern about the use of judgment and a couple of people saying, how would this work in particular circumstances? How would you actually do it? Another one asking, well, if one company got to one conclusion and another company got to another conclusion, does that mean one's wrong and one's right? Or my point of view on that is this is principle-based, judgment-based, and maybe sometimes people will come to different conclusions in somewhat similar circumstances. And that's the way, it's very different from how it's been done in the US before, but that's the way I think the standard works. So without trying to guess what the boards will think about this, I do think that we had reasonably unanimous views on how these matters should be treated. And the standard, I think, is relatively clear. I'd be willing to listen to anybody who doesn't agree with my summing up, by the way, so that we have a fair discussion.